Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to episode number 362 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is it's March 16th, 2015. February's long gone. We're always halfway to April already, but March 16th, 2015, we got a big show we want to talk about. USC being on spring break, finishing up the first 2 weeks of spring football and a full pad scrimmage in the Coliseum. And we got Coach Harvey Hyde on secret assignment this week, so we're going to do a full show with USCFootball.com beat writer Dan Weber. A lot of questions to get to. We want to get Dan's insights on everything that's been going on the first couple weeks of spring football. We do want to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments, as always, just drop us an email. podcast@USCFootball.com is our email address, or give us a call at 206-888-6755. Or you can go to our website, peristylepodcast.com. Leave a voicemail just by clicking on the left side of the page. You can do it right from your computer. So lots of ways to get a hold of us. We'd love to hear from you. Try to keep those voicemails short so we can play them on the air. We'll have one of those for you today as well. And without further ado, wanted to bring in Coach Harvey. Excuse me, not Coach Harvey. Dan, I'm coming off a little vacation. Went to spring training in Arizona. I'm a little off today, but welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on.
And you're probably celebrating St. Patrick's Day Eve also, so what the heck, you know.
I think I celebrate a little
getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, it is St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. But wanted to get some thoughts from you to start with on this Coliseum scrimmage. And, we got to talk off air a little bit, and I got to read your reports and check out the, the videos and stuff from the practice. But I guess it's a little different, being the sixth practice, and it's kind of like this bridge for Steve Sarkisian to go from spring practice part one, where they do 2 weeks and then they take a week off, 10 days off, and then go into spring practice part two. It's kind of an interesting concept that they've been using lately the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I agree with Steve said that, he loves it. It really gives you two different spring practices, and I think he's correct. It's amazing. They've got, a week off to kind of recharge their batteries and then 3 weeks to finish. And I was thinking, I think on the Pac-12 network over the weekend, Colorado was already playing their spring game.
Wow.
So, I think it's good planning, good schedule, good idea. I think what we saw Saturday was more, not so much that kind of a first team scrimmage, but a chance for guys who they really wanted to really evaluate, see how they fit in, where they're going to be. Guys like Lamont Simmons, cornerback, 6'2", 185, rangy, got more, chance to play with the first team. They didn't feel like I think they needed to play Adoree and Sua all that much. And, Stephen Mitchell, for example, really gets a chance to shine, and Darius Rogers at wide receiver. Soma Vanuku gets a chance to carry the ball. And that was kind of a good thing. I think it really helps the coaches now take the, 8 or 9 days between practices to say, how do we factor all this in? Where do these guys go? You look at a Cameron Smith and they say, wow, this kid. And then it tells you something probably how difficult it is to do rankings of high school players, because, obviously nobody knew more about Cameron Smith than USC. I mean, they were recruiting him. They liked him. He's coached in high school at Granite Bay by Dallas Sartz. You've got everything you could possibly think you could know. They get him here and they say, wow, he's way more athletic than we realized. Wow. He can rush the quarterback. He can drop. He's getting these great drops and on the interceptions. And I think, who would have known more about Cameron than the USC coaches? And yet they feel like now that they're watching him practice, they're thinking, whoa, he's more than we bargained for. We didn't realize he could do this, and he could do this the way he's doing it. So I guess, you know, and a big part of what we do at, you know, we do at Scout is evaluate kids. But I think it makes the point how hard that is, and that's a really challenging thing to do. And now you get them here, and you see things. You said, wow, didn't see that. And that's been a kind of a blessing, I think, for USC to see, you know, guys like Cameron and Lamont. And for the coaches, Lamar Dawson is kind of a new guy. And they're really, I think, amazed at the things they're seeing him do, running plays down from behind, you know, grabbing guys, you know, when he gets his hand on you, you're down, you're not going anywhere, you know. They didn't ever get to see Lamar do that. And now they're getting you know, to see that from him. So I think those are the things that, you know, that really jumped out at you the first couple of weeks. And we'll see how that changes what they're going to do, but, you know, going forward.
You know, it's interesting that I was reading what you were writing about Cameron Smith and, of course, what you're just saying. And of the four linebackers coming in, he was the early enrollee guy, but wasn't as – you know, he wasn't the late signing. He was the guy that's been committed for a long time. And I guess sometimes in the fans' eyes could be a little bit of an afterthought, you know, with John Houston or Osa Messina or Porter Gustin. And, you know, I think the fans will love that, seeing him coming in and being able to contribute right away, especially because we still haven't seen him. I mean, he's a guy, when we would see him, Dan, at different camps, he's out there as a middle linebacker covering running backs and stuff. They're not in pads. That really wasn't the strength of his game when he was in high school. Now you get to see him actually with pads on, doing some things, and not just being like a run-stopper kind of guy, but actually making plays in space, which is something I know he worked on, you know, his senior year in high school. I think it's a really nice thing to see. But he was kind of the afterthought guy of those four linebackers coming in.
Although I will say this, the USC coaches kept saying, no, he's going to be absolutely our guy in there. He's the one we think we know that much about, where he belongs. And I just don't know that they realized he had the kind of range and the kind of judgment that, you know, you look out there and there he is in the right place, you know, or he's the one making the break on the ball. You think, wow, you know, this kid still should be in high school. And he looks like, I mean, you know, I would say the closest I can come to, he reminds me of Ray Nitschke. I mean, he just looks like that kind of guy. You know, he's the same size. He kind of lumbers, you know, that kind of a, you know, an old throw, you know, a throwback NFL linebacker. And I think that the nice thing about that is it will give you more flexibility with the guys coming in. If you've got pretty much, you know, that taken care of. I mean, here they are in a situation where Anthony Sorrell now, you know, on a motorized wheelchair with, you know, operation on his foot. So here's your one starting, you know, one linebacker is, you know, Hayes Fillard is gone, and the other one is, you know, after surgery. And they feel like, you know, they're upgraded there right now. That's a real plus for this spring. If you just said one position, you know, inside linebackers, you feel like you're already upgraded, and, you know, you've got other help coming in, but I think that was one of the real positive developments, you know, for this spring already in the first six practices.
Yeah, so six practices down, got nine more to go, but the 10 days off here. I guess maybe your impressions, Dan, from the, you know, the first couple of weeks, anything that really, you know, stood out to you? I mean, there's a bunch of guys that need to be replaced, and we're kind of seeing some of the younger guys emerge. But any big storylines stick out for you the first couple of weeks?
I think Stephen Mitchell's ability to be a home run hitter. I just think he may have, you know, slightly more ability to make a cut and take it all the way than anybody we've seen, other than, you know, say in the last 5 years, other than maybe a completely healthy Marquise. He just has that ability. And I think they've really figured out some combination things to do with him and Juju on the same side of the ball. And I think they'll do the same thing with Adoree and Juju and really force teams into mismatches. But I think that the thing you like now is if they get a mismatch, a linebacker on, say, Steven, or let's say, just say a linebacker on Steven, and the guy, you know, can't stay with him, and the safety comes up and takes the wrong angle on a slant, let's say. Steven will try to take it to the end zone just right now. And I don't know that we've exactly seen that kind of ability to stop start on a dime. I mean, he's got some of those, you know, characteristics that you always loved about, you know, some of the great classic USC teams that had guys that could do that, stop start and take it to the end zone. And that's a big equalizer, having that home run hitter. So I think we are seeing, you know, some of that. I think we're seeing how difficult it is to figure out how do you cover, you know, Juju and Adoree, let's say, on the same side, or Juju and Steven. And you have to basically single up on Juju. If you do that, he's just bigger and stronger and more athletic. And if you come up and really try to take something away from him, he can beat you deep. So I think they're starting to say, okay, we can do this or we can do that, and they can see it, you know, quickly when they line up. On the other side, we're seeing Kevon Seymour, for example, I think understands he's really got to develop that shutdown corner ability if he wants to go on and play at the next level the way he does. And we're seeing that. We're seeing things that we haven't, you know, seen from Kevon. He's healthy. He's confident. I mean, he's just not letting people catch the ball in front of him. And I think the mix and match that they're doing, where there's not a big difference between the safeties and the corners and how they're playing, and how they're, you know, they don't need a big size difference, and that they've got guys that are mostly strong enough to play safety. And a lot of these teams that USC is going to be playing, you better be able to defend four guys man-to-man. And I think they're making the move to be able to do that, because as Sark said, you can't just defend, you know, man-to-man, you know, in a couple of plays. You better be ready to defend, you know, man-to-man all over the field if you're going to play that way. They want to play that way. They're trying to figure out, you know, do we have the personnel? Last year, I think they were really afraid. They didn't. I think they may have underrated it and maybe just undertaught it, undercoached it. But, you know, they're really seriously, you know, going out and saying, we got to be able to take things away from people. Last year, I don't think on defense they took things away from people enough. So those are a couple of the storylines. I think the offensive line, we've seen a little bit more attempt to really do some power running with Soma as the big back, with Trey Madden not able to be there. And I do think, you know, that ability to just wedge it out. And, you know, I think the offensive line understands, you know, when Soma is in there, you do see a little bit more of that, you know, just man-on-man, you know, blow them out off the line of scrimmage that we didn't see last year. That they didn't have confidence that when they needed that third and two, that they could do it and get it. And I think that's a positive development as well.
All right, Dan. Well, let's jump into some of these questions about USC spring football. Let's see. Let's go first. We have a simple one. We'll start with that one. It's not a simple answer, but it's a simple question from Andrew. Who is the better-looking player, Sua or Adoree? So we're talking about Sua Cravens or Adoree Jackson.
You know, I think they're such different-looking players. Sua looks, you know, when he lost some weight with a bout with the flu and got down to 210 and looked much more like a safety. But when he's at, you know, going to be playing about 220, you know, you look at him and he's, you know, this sort of, you know, Adonis-looking, you know, character. And the amazing thing about Adoree, he's so not normal-looking. He just, until he starts moving. And then I remember one of the first times when they loosen up the whole team and they do them in lines and they just take one with a kick. They do a kick across their opposite shoulder. And as they're walking, and that's just kind of loosen up their hip muscles and just, you know, just the general loosening up. And I'm noticing that, like, Adoree's kick is like a foot higher than everybody else's on the team. It didn't matter who you are or how big you are or whatever. he's got a set of athletic skills, confidence that goes into it, hands, timing, ability to make plays in the air, all those things. And so you're looking at two different – they're both guys that can make plays on the ball. They're both guys that can close on the football in, at the last minute in ways in which you think, how did he get from here to there? That's a big advantage in a game where, you know, the football really matters. But they're both absolutely special in their own way. And, you know, two of the more special athletes in the country. I don't think there's any question. They were in high school. They are now. USC's job, I think, is just to free those guys to be able to make, you know, use of their special talents on the football in space. You know, I wouldn't want to pick one over the other. I mean, it might be, you know, you like the, this particular look. Adoree, you like the way Adoree looks when he's making a play in the air, in space. Sua might win the battle if you were saying which one of these two guys looks better standing there. You might pick, you know, you might pick Sua, you know, for that one. But when they're making plays on the ball, with the ball in space, they both got, you know, some really special, unique qualities.
All right. Thanks for that one, Andrew. We'll go to Melvin. Had a couple questions, Dan. His first one, he said, "What do you think will end up? Who do you think will end up as the starting tight end, especially in view of the off-the-field problems with Dixon and Cope Fitzpatrick? If USC lacks depth at this position, do you think they will just go to using more wideouts or not even use a tight end?"
I don't. I think trying to guess that one right now would be probably not very much value. They haven't used as much of the tight end in spring, which is, you know, makes sense to see what your options are. I mean, I think they've got a number of ways to go there. I think Connor Spears, though, has been definitely running number one. He's 6'6", 240. As Stark said, he's fast enough. He does catch the ball in the seam, catches it in a crowd. Doesn't look too big for him. He's, you know, transfer from Columbia. Kid has kind of lived all over the world, or at least he was born in Dublin, Ireland, and lived all over the U.S. And it's kind of a, you know, a kid that just sort of seems to be able to rise to the occasion. Whether Chris Wilson is in that, you know, picture or not, it looks like, and with Jalen Fitzpatrick eligible again, and Tyler Pettit coming in, you would guess, not knowing about Bryce Dixon, you would guess it's going to be by committee. And I do think that Sark has mentioned that at Washington, the one year they ran out of tight ends, they went with two running backs and, you know, a fullback, and they tried to do some of the same things with the, you know, blocking at the point of attack with the fullback. And they're throwing the ball to the fullback. I mean, Sua caught a pass the other day on the fifth play, when they do the five final plays, that was the gave the win to the offense. So I think they're going to be experimenting with exactly how do they handle that. And, you know, if they have a sense of how the Dixon case is going to turn out, they certainly haven't indicated as such. And I think it's probably not knowable now as to, you know, where he's going to be or how he's going to be. One would think he's not going to be there for spring at all, even though, again, they're not going to comment on it. So they're going to explore a lot of alternatives. But I just think right now all you know is that they're going to try to do a lot of things and see which ones look the best to them right now. But you can't even know all of those options because you don't really know who's going to be there. You know, Will Dixon be there? Will Wilson be there? How quickly, you know, does the, you know, freshman Pettit step up? Unknowable.
And then he had one other question for you, Dan. He said, during spring practice, have you noticed or seen any distinct changes made by Justin Wilcox that was different from last year's defensive schemes and strategy? That's from Melvin.
Yeah, there's no question. They're really playing a lot more press. They're blitzing from different places, more unexpected of the kind that you remember with Pete, and where they're well timed and the kids seem comfortable doing them. It looks like they become more of a playmaking, have more of a playmaking philosophy on defense. Last year, it looked like more they were just trying to hold on, not screw up, not get embarrassed, not get beat deep, those kinds of things. This year, looks like they're going to try to figure out who are our playmakers and how can we put them in position to make plays, and can we be confident that we have enough athletes who we can depend on, to come up and play press coverage and take people out of the game and just one-on-one trust them that you can do this. So, yeah, we're seeing more of that. I'm seeing more of a, confident Wilcox in his players and in his own maybe ability to, call a game. And as Ryan documented last year, USC was about as far down on the list of teams that would blitz or like to blitz or trusted to blitz as any team in the Power Five conferences, and it doesn't seem to be the case now.
All right, let's move on to Tarek. He says, in his lone start last season, Michael Hutchins left a lot to be desired. What have you seen from him this spring? And with the good things that Cam Smith is doing, do you see him being a dark horse to be the starting middle linebacker?
I think Michael has made significant improvements. I think he knows he's playing. He knows what his role is. He just looks like he's grown up. He just looks more comfortable out there. I mean, this is one of the benefits of not having, say, Anthony, out there is, a guy like Michael gets much more of a chance to play. You'll see him in there with Lamar a lot. And I think he's, another reason to feel good about that, that middle linebacker, that inside linebacker, those two positions, just because he looks like he's ready to get, to get the job. Now, I'm encouraged from what I've seen about Michael the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, and for me, Dan, when you watch him in the offseason, he's a leader. Like, he's been a leader out there. He'll grab the clipboard. He's helping some of the younger guys, and it just seems like his head's in the right place. And then we got to see what he's doing on Saturdays. I think we'll get a lot more chances to see him this year. But I think his leadership out there has been really good, and someone that has a cerebral approach to the game and playing that position.
Well, I think we always were waiting to see when that De La Salle background would kick in.
Yeah,
I think there's no question. You feel like those kids are coming from a different place, and I think that's his time is now, I think he believes, and I think we're seeing that.
Troy 75 had a question. Not these guys aren't in the spring, but there's been a lot of talk about replacing Leonard Williams, and he said, how quickly do you see defensive linemen, he's talking about Jacob Daniel, Rasheem Green, and Noah Jefferson making contributions on the defense? It seems that a major concern will be replacing Leonard Williams. Will these freshmen be able to help right away? That's from Troy 75.
That's going to be an interesting – I think that'll be one of the more challenging things to do in August because you'll have three veterans coming back, Kenny Bigelow and Antoine Woods and Greg Townsend Jr., who I don't know if he's getting back this this spring or not. But so you're going to – you're going to want to, bring those guys in. You're basically going with just the four, Cody Temple and Malik Thornton and Claude Pilon and Delwan Simmons this spring. So you're going to want to incorporate those guys. And I know, the way it has always gone at USC is you really do want to give the young guys a chance. So I'll be interested to see how that all works because that's, that's like six guys that you've got to kind of work in who weren't basically a part of the spring. And I think you're seeing them in the talk from the D-line guys all is the way you replace a Leonard Williams is you do it as a group. You do it as a, you know, a combination effort. And how that works, if you've got guys that have been working all spring and working pretty well. I mean, I think if Cody Temple stays healthy, he's a real viable option, you know, at the nose. And I think Claude and Delvon both realize this is it. You know, if they're going to go on and, you know, play at the next level, they've got to, you know, show what they can do and really step up this year, and they know the opportunities there. So how you incorporate those other seven guys, you know, with the including the freshmen, I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly who's got the maturity, you know, to be able to maybe be the breakout guy in the freshman group and find a way into, you know, the rotation. I think that'll be probably the most at this point, I would say that one would be the most difficult to predict how it's going to go in terms of personnel, how that rotation is going to turn out. But keep your eye on it.
There was also last week, during in the middle of the practices, USC had their pro day, got to see some of the former Trojans perform. And this was a question about Andre Walker, so I thought it'd be appropriate since we're, you know, we got to see him run at the pro day. Earl in West LA says, is there a backstory about Andre Walker? It looked like he had won the job back when he filled in superbly for the injured Chad Wheeler in the second half against Utah. After that game, he never played again. Do you think the coaching staff opted to give the offensive line of the future more game experience working together? Did Andre fall out of favor, or did someone else or something else come into play? His performance against Utah seemed to merit more playing time, but that did not happen, and I'm curious to know why.
We think maybe his performance against Utah was maybe more highly rated, maybe from the outside than from the inside. I think there were assignment issues. I just think it was a sense of being on top of his game and being on top of the game and into the, you know, into the moment and all that, that I just don't think they felt, you know, was there. I mean, the thing with Andre, he always looked like, I mean, he, you know, he looked like the prototype, you know, college tackle going to the NFL guy. But I think they just didn't have a sense that they could absolutely be certain of where, you know, Andre's head was on every play and in every practice. And I don't think it was anything more than that. It wasn't, you know, and, you know, no personal or nothing like that. It's just a matter of focus and, you know, concentration and ability to feel like, you know, and if it's, you know, between a freshman and a senior, you would think you'd always give the, you know, you'd give it to the freshman. I mean, you'd just say, hey, this kid's got three more years. And in the case, if that left tackle is more dependable. So I think that's, you know, I wouldn't read too much into that. I think it was pretty much strictly performance-based and practice-based and, you know, classroom-based, all of that kind of thing. Than anything.
All right. Marcel and Diamond Bar had a question about the schedule. He wants to know, can you explain what goes into the selection of the non-conference opponents for USC other than Notre Dame? Is it recruitment, wins, or what?
Well, you know, one game, I mean, you'd like to have two home games every year, you know, and get you to the 7-5, which would be ideal. And it's harder in the Pac-12 because you play a 9-game conference schedule. So every other year you're playing 4 games at home and 5 on the road in the Pac-12. So it'd be a lot easier if you were the 8-game SEC model. So, and USC usually had a second game that you were pretty happy about. So for example, next year that would have been the Texas A&M game. So USC would have been playing both Texas A&M and Notre Dame, and you got to get those, you know, staggered so that, you know, you're not playing on the road at a, say, a Texas or a Texas A&M the same year you're playing Notre Dame on the road, and then Texas A&M joins the SEC, whatever, 4 years ago and drops USC from the home and home games. So then USC's scrambling to get a second home game, and they only wanted one for a year. So now you're basically going to buy a game, and you know, that's where you know you end up with an Arkansas State and an Idaho in back-to-back, you know, opening games. Still, if you look at USC's three non-conference game next year, just going to Notre Dame probably gives you a tougher non-conference schedule than, you know, probably everybody in the SEC, or at least 10 teams in the SEC. It probably gives you a tougher non-conference schedule than most everybody in the Pac-12, really. But I think USC was scrambling next year for non-conference games because Texas A&M dropped them. But USC only has a margin of they've got two games to deal with, and they're going to pick up Texas in a couple of years, home and home. So that helps. But they haven't had as much luck. Teams seem to be, if they're going to come to L.A., more willing to play UCLA at the Rose Bowl than USC at the Coliseum. I don't think there's just, even with, you know, UCLA having done, you know, better the last couple of years, they're still you don't find teams that are that crazy about coming to the Coliseum to play USC.
That's very true. We'll see. Yeah, people forget. They forget about Notre Dame, Dan. They just say, oh, well, what besides Notre Dame? Well, Notre Dame's on the schedule every year. So I think that's just with the nine conference games in Notre Dame, then you know you got 10 good ones. And I don't mind if they try to sneak in a couple extra home games every once in a while. But they're still, you know, better teams on the schedule. And next year you got Alabama and stuff. So I don't think the schedule for me is ever going to be that big of an issue as far as if USC wins if you're worried about what's the national perception and are they going to make the playoff. I think if USC wins the Pac-12, barring some crazy thing where they lose, you know, three times or something, they're gonna be making the playoff.
Yeah, and they're still, you know, they've never never scheduled down. They never scheduled below, you know, the Division I. And only three teams, UCLA and Notre Dame, are the only other two of all the Division I teams that haven't done that. I noticed when they picked up Western Michigan, for one of those games in the future, and it was the first time USC to ever schedule a Mid-American Conference team, which surprises me. But you know, a Mid-American Conference, pretty good conference. What I would get worried about is something I think I threw it into the war room a couple of weeks ago about Tennessee. And at the end of each week, we get a little update on college football around the country from the National Football Foundation, and they give you little blurbs about what's happening at different programs around the country. And the first blurb was East Tennessee State is going to start football, and tryouts are, you know, in a couple of weeks, and that was the announcement number one. Announcement number three was, the University of Tennessee has scheduled East Tennessee State. Now, they haven't, you know, in 2020 or whatever it is, 2018, I think it was. I'm thinking, this is a school, he hasn't even had a practice yet, and they're already on Tennessee's schedule. That would worry me. I'm USC, and you're scheduling teams that haven't practiced yet because they don't have any players. That's not who you want to be scheduling.
Yeah.
As long as USC doesn't do that, I'm okay with it.
Interesting. All right. Well, here's one from W. He said, one of your callers recently, he's talking about the callers on the podcast, said that the Syracuse basketball coach was given similar penalties to what Pete Carroll would have been given if he stayed at USC. I thought there was nothing truly negative about Coach Carroll in the NCAA report. Plus, wasn't Chip Kelly already gone from Oregon when the penalties against him were given out? Of course, those penalties do not really amount to much once a coach has left the school. I am still amazed how many ESPN and Fox quote-unquote experts still say things like the penalties for USC paying their players or the house that was bought for Reggie's family, etc. I can understand fans being so ignorant or having a bias, but why are these quote-unquote experts so misinformed? That's from W.
You know, I think one of the problems was they all bought into it at the time, and they willfully remained relatively ignorant because it would make them, you know, appear that they had absolutely nothing, you know, no, they were completely incorrect in their judgment of the USC case. I think most of them have come around now. They know the NCAA framed the USC, the penalties were ridiculous, that the NCAA acted, you know, just terribly in the case. And yet you will have hear that thrown in, because I think a lot of it is, well, the NCAA wouldn't have punished them the way they did, considering they're not punishing anybody for anything anymore, unless there was something really there. And the fact that USC chose over the last, you know, 4.5 years not to really defend itself publicly, not to stand up for itself, helps that assumption. You know, people think, well, what the heck? If our school would have been so unfairly treated, our people would have screamed to high heaven and would have gone crazy. And nobody at USC has said much of anything other than, you know, we'll try to do it, you know, right, you know, the next time. Makes you, you know, if you're an outsider, you can say, well, you know, I've not heard USC scream about this or threaten about it or do anything. And so there's other schools were threatening the NCAA before they even got penalized. USC gets penalized so unfairly, and they don't even threaten them after they get penalized. So I think that helps people throw those charges out there, because USC has done such a poor job of defending itself.
And I think even people that know what's going on, sometimes you just, it kind of gets lumped into things. I mean, Colin Cowherd from ESPN is a friend of the show. He's a, you know, closet USC fan. He knows what's going on. And I heard him going on a rant about all this NCAA stuff the other day. And he talked about, you know, Reggie Bush, and mentioned a booster, like, you know, getting his family getting money from a booster, which, you know, completely wasn't the... It was like a wannabe agent. It wasn't a booster. So even people that know what's going on here, it's been so long, and you just kind of
well,
hear...
I mean, and yeah. You have to know all the details. For example, the only way that guy was classified as a booster was the NCAA changed the definition of booster.
Yes.
In a way that changed... They had, you know, said that this guy wasn't a booster. Then they changed it. So you have to know, like, all the details of the case to know that, wait a minute, this is the guy that hired more UCLA students or former UCLA players than USC players, but all of a sudden in the USC case, he was a booster. You know, the NCAA did so many things that it's hard for outsiders to realize, no, that guy wasn't a booster.
Right.
I wanted to be, you know, Reggie's agent. And in no way, shape, or form was he a USC booster. He had no connection to USC's program. The NCAA just defined him as that, and that was one of the many things that the NCAA did to rig the case. You're right.
We're going to have Patrick has a few things for you, and then we're going to do our favorite basketball caller, and we'll wrap up the show that way. But Patrick had a few things. I'll read the first one, let you comment on each one of these. He said, I'm very sad to see the big cat go. He's talking about Leonard Williams. Seems to bring a fresh personality to football. He, more than anyone I can remember, seems to act like a quote-unquote regular college student that is just great at football.
He's a wonderful kid. What a break that he chose to come to USC. Good for Leonard. You know, good for USC. It's really neat to see those kids who you know, got punished for things they didn't have anything to do with. And they... You know, now that they're leaving, when you hear, you know, you talk to Nelson and Buck and Leonard, they so, you know, care for USC, and they so are, you know, happy that they were, you know, part of the USC community. And you know, we all probably should be just as happy about Leonard as Leonard was about USC. He's a one of, you know, one in a million. And I think he charmed everybody, like at the Combine or these NFL teams are like, is this for real? Is this kid this good a kid? Is this kid this, you know, yeah, that's who he really is. But you don't see Leonard, you know, guys like Leonard come along very, very often. Just a treasure.
And his second point was, wonder what your thoughts are on the Todd McNair case. Do we really want the stories to come out? I know it will damn the NCAA, but will there also be some shady stories that will come out that will reflect negatively on USC?
Well, the only negative story I can see coming out on at USC is why the hell didn't you fight this a little harder?
Yep.
Why didn't you fight to get those emails out yourself or get to see them yourself? That's the most negative. You know, why did you get, you know, not get the right advice, you know, 4 years ago in terms of what your options might be to get some of the sanctions back and to figure out exactly what the NCAA did to you and not give up your, you know, any kind of negotiating position that you might have had to back the NCAA down. That's the most negative thing I think that's going to come out. Let's face it, the NCAA had anything that they thought they could use, they would have used it. I mean, they you know, they've embarrassed themselves. I mean, when any of these details come out about what they did in the USC investigation and prosecution, they, you know, strained so hard and they did things so improperly and so sloppily. If they had any kind of slam dunk, you know, stuff on USC, they'd have used it. Unfortunately, they didn't have it, which is why they had to, you know, throw Todd McNair in, and then they realized, uh-oh, we probably can't do that, you know, there are for a number of reasons, and yet they still left it in the case. And because they, you know, it would have been almost impossible, no matter what anybody says, if they couldn't have come up with a connection to someone at USC who knew anything, there's no way they could have. No matter how much they changed the rules and all the parameters about what you can and can't do, they couldn't have done to USC anything nearly what they did had they not had a connection to a member of the coaching staff. And and so if they had anything better than that, you can absolutely believe it was in there, because they threw in stuff that, you know, that they were desperate. They spent 4 years on it, the longest investigation in NCAA history. They were so certain going into it that they were going to come up with just scads of stuff, thinking, you know, if this were an SEC team, this were, a, you know, a some of the, you know, old Southwest Conference type teams, to be as good as USC, they'd have had to cheat so badly. And so they just figured USC's got to be cheating. Then they get into the case and they go, uh-oh, we can't find anything. Then they ended up having to make stuff up. If they had anything, they wouldn't have had to make stuff up. And so, to me, that tells me that, you know, the only worries are USC's going to look bad for not having defended itself more publicly and more vigorously.
No, I agree with you on that, Dan, but that is something that is a kind of, I don't know, it's a theory that's out there, just because you'd think that, well, there's got to be a reason why the USC's not fighting back, and there's other bad things that the NCAA just kept the lid on, and they didn't want it to get out and things like that. But, man, like, they did have to kind of, you know, there was fabrications or, you know, talking behind the scenes while this was all, you know, all the emails that we want to see come out, all the, you know, the nefarious business practices that the NCAA used. So that does make sense that if they had more, I don't see why they wouldn't throw it in there. You know, there's no secret deal behind the scenes that we're not going to talk about all these other bad things that USC did, because we don't want this to get out there. But we're going to punish you like we know.
Yeah, I'm gonna imagine there is not an email that says, "Man, we've got USC on this and this, and we've got evidence of this and this, but let's not use that."
Yeah,
you know, let's try to tie him into a phone call that was from the wrong year, made by the wrong person, and after Reggie Bush was finished with his eligibility. Yeah, let's try to do that. And then we got this picture from a bar scene that God knows that, you know, whatever, you know, still people will debate whether it's Photoshopped or not. But no, there's no, we've got him on this or we've got him on that. And we'll just hold that back. You know, for what purpose? Why would they hold anything back? I mean, it makes no sense. You know, it just, there's, you know, and people say, well, everybody does this. Everybody. Yeah, I mean, is there something that, you know, somebody did that every other school in America does? Well, you know, would they be hiding, you know, would they say, you know, in a case that, we're only going to punish USC for it, but everybody does it, and USC might be even forced to defend itself And that was, I think, 4 years ago somebody started that out, that, well, there were some other things, and there aren't any other things now. Once those other things, once those were not part of the case, they're not part of the case. There, if there was anything there, it's not there now. Because it's either part of the case or it's not part of the case. We're only talking about the case. We're not talking about... And the problem the NCAA would have is if they came up with anything else now, they've so discredited themselves and their methods and the same people who would be involved in it, it wouldn't matter anyway. Nobody's going to believe them. So yeah, I think that was an attempt at explaining USC's failure to defend itself. There is another explanation to USC's failure to defend itself, and it's not a good one for USC, but it's probably the correct one, and it's almost certainly the correct one. They didn't want to look like a football school. They didn't want to look like a school that cared that much about, you know, even though Notre Dame would go to, you know, the end of the earth to defend its football program, and that's never hurt Notre Dame's standing as a serious, you know, academic university. I would tell you that, you know, North Carolina always wanted to act like they were a serious academic university, a top 25 university. And look what's happened there. And they've gone to the ends of the earth to try to defend themselves about the bogus classes and all that. And, probably in a way that they weren't the most honest about how they investigated all of that went on at North Carolina. And yet nobody has, they're going to get shot down for what happened in athletics. But I don't think anybody has said this, lessens North Carolina as an academic institution. And why USC thought that would have made USC look like a less serious, program, I don't know. I think they got some bad advice from people.
One last one for Patrick. He said, I've asked this before, but it didn't get answered, so I want to ask again. Sorry about that, Patrick, but here you go. Instead of paying athletes, has the possibility of paying insurance policies for players an option? With the risk of injury, I'm sure many players opt to go pro before they are ready so they can get some guarantees, some support for their families. If they knew that they had some money coming, should they get injured, maybe we could retain a few. Thanks for the great stuff, fellas. Patrick.
Interesting thought. The way the insurance policies now, the ones that ensure your value against the draft and, decreased earnings are, and since it appears they don't want to pay on any of those policies, I would say the whole question of insuring athletes is one that people are pretty hesitant about right now. Whether you could, set up a generalized class of insurance, and I don't know, I guess it would just be insurance against injury, but how would you define what exactly, what you would hope now is you're covered with all medical expenses and all, how you cover that in the future once they're out of school is a good question. And it's probably an area somebody ought to take a look at. Is there a way of kind of doing that? The problem the NCAA's got with that is they have, stated since the 1950s that student athletes are not employees. So they didn't want to cover them with the workman's comp, for example, and all of that kind of thing, because then they'd have to, admit that they were employees. And they fought like crazy not to put the, student athletes in a class of employees. And what the insurability situation is for an athlete, for example, could they give them all grants and let the student athletes buy their own insurance? I don't know. As a cost of attendance, not sure how they ought to go about that. But I would tell you that's probably an area that everybody's going to be looking at when they start, awarding, 4-year scholarships and paying kids the true cost of education. Something like that, I'm sure, probably, which should be investigated. And how would you do it? I don't know. But But it's something to, you know, something to think about.
And I think it'd be really hard to do, Dan. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Marquise Lee is suing Lloyd's of London over his policy not being paid. And when you're talking about insurance, you have to insure against something. You get a car insurance, it's insurance against an accident. I mean, if you get an oil leak or, you know, your transmission goes, your insurance doesn't cover that. Whereas for a player, I mean, they don't get drafted very high, or they don't get drafted at all. I think to make it equatable to, instead of paying a player or something, you pay for their insurance policy. The insurance policy is only going to work for very certain players. You know, it's going to be a surefire guy that if he comes back and gets injured, he's not able to, you know, make that kind of living in the NFL. I just don't think that would, even in the situation, if you could do that, I don't think it would be addressing enough of the problem, because it really only works for a handful of players every year.
Yeah, the thing I was thinking is, was Patrick talking about the possibility of a team-wide insurance plan which would insure guys against, say, future medical expenses for injuries or, you know, whatever happens to them in college, so that if those stay with them for the rest of their life, for example, or if their, you know, medical expenses that come up once they're out of college and that you could still be covered for those. And this is a bad analogy probably, but, you know, for guys that, you know, in the service who suffer, you know, service-connected disabilities, that they have, you know, lifetime care, would that be something that you know, to be fair to these guys? Because you don't know what happens to kids. You know, they get the surgery done or they get, you know, this and that done, but if they have a lifetime of some medical, you know, issues, how do they take care of those? That would be maybe something that they could take a look at. It would seem where you don't have to evaluate based on how good they, you know, were, what their future earnings are going to be or anything. Just more like a basic kind of lifetime insurance policy against something that might happen while you're in college.
All right. And then we got one last topic, USC hoops. Of course, USC had an upset win over Arizona State in the Pac-12 tournament. And then got beat pretty badly by UCLA, who actually did end up making the NCAA tournament. Who knows, if USC was able to win that game, maybe that keeps UCLA out of the NCAA tournament. But and speaking of, we do have a really cool scout, brand new scout tournament game. If you go to uscfootball.com, you can check it out. But you get a mulligan. You get to play week by week. So there's prizes after every week. So if you pick a team that loses in the first round, it's okay. You can come back next week and you get to start from scratch. So it should be interesting. But this is specifically about USC basketball, Dan, and I'll play the voicemail for you right now.
This is Richard, the USC basketball fan. Well, I was almost lulled into thinking that Opie could actually coach after SC beat Arizona State, but sadly, they were blown away by the Bruins, and I'm wondering what Dan's comments are as we go into next year. As I mentioned, if it starts off the way it ended, they have to have something in place, and not only is Opie going to be on the hot seat, I would think Hayden would be too, as far as the coaching is concerned. So, Dan, I would love to hear your comments. Appreciate the show, and fight on. Bye.
Yeah, I'm actually working on I'm more involved with the NCAA basketball tournament this year for some reason, and I don't know why. But the sad thing here is, if you're a USC basketball fan, in this week when everybody gets excited about the NCAA tournament, I didn't realize that when you look at the numbers, that $9 billion of gambling activity compared to, say, $4 billion for the Super Bowl, or that the total dollars, broadcast dollars on the NCAA tournament are more than on the Super Bowl and all of those things. And if you're a USC basketball fan, you feel completely disconnected from all of that. And that, you know, there's no reason for that. I mean, here you are, you know, you're in the town that's without a doubt produces the most high school basketball, or, you know, college basketball talent out of the high school program. I mean, you can't turn on a game without a kid from Los Angeles doing this or doing that, and NBA or college. And here's USC just sitting here totally on the sidelines for even the year they got to go and play in the play-in game with Kevin O'Neill. USC was still on the sidelines, even with a team that was probably better than VCU. One more year of totally on the sidelines. Somebody told me that it was in Las Vegas that the USC kids thought they'd won the tournament when they beat Arizona State, and didn't realize that there'd be another game, and you're playing the third game of the year against your arch rivals, and you don't show up ready to play. And then somebody else said, there's just no way they match up. You can't guard that. USC can't guard that UCLA team. And I'm thinking, yeah, that UCLA team that scored, 7 points in the first half against Kentucky, that real athletic UCLA team. I mean, the lack of effort on defense and the lack of kind of an ability to even understand what you have to do to defend a UCLA, for example, gives you worry. I mean, there's real worry. I mean, you can't brag about him in the number 12 recruiting class in the country in October and then say, in December, January, February, March, we're just not big enough, strong enough, mature enough, good enough. We're not any better now than we were 4 months ago. And it's a worry. There are people you look at Oregon and Oregon State, and you think, basically Oregon got most of their team just wiped out with, various kinds of scandals at the end of the year. And they show up because they got a coach who can coach, and they don't let that stop them. And I just think coaching really matters in college basketball. And I think USC needed a quicker turnaround than they've developed. I mean, you can say, well, it's going to take a long time. USC can't afford for it to take a long time because of where it was and all the previous mistakes and the allowing Kevin O'Neill to stay, at least a couple of years longer than he should have been allowed to stay, and which is why you probably don't start out from scratch. But that's what USC, tried to do. Last year was a complete wipeout. They made all the wrong decisions with the transfers. And this year we're going to build with, recruits. And I don't know that those recruits are playing at a higher level, maybe, Elijah Stewart, whatever. But game for game for game, you don't see that. And you don't see a sense of this is who we are. This is how we win games at USC. And so are they going to start from scratch again next year? And are they going to get stronger? I mean, you can say, well, these kids are still weak and they need a lot of weight room work and all that. But you recruited them a year ago. What have they been doing, in that year, since then? And they just need a whole lot of things to start going right here. And and we're going to, we don't want a rerun of this year, next year. But is there anything to say there's a lot of confidence that that won't happen? No. I don't think we, based on the way, the season ended, I don't think there's any confidence level that they'll figure it out. You wish they would. I like Andy, personally, good guy, like the kids, but they shouldn't be where they are. This team should have been more productive this year and been more competitive and in more games and figured out ways at the end to win more games, and they didn't do any of that. And we wanted to feel like going out of this season, okay, this is something to build on. But I don't know that you look at this year and see elements that you say, well, we can build on this. And so I don't know where that leaves. USC at this point in time, but it's in a bad place. It shouldn't be with that building and where USC is and and what really is a basketball town now. They shouldn't be 11th in attendance in the Pac-12 with that new building. Much more convenient place to get to than Poly, for example, for evening games. And yet, drawing, a little over 3,000 people is not the way to go.
All right. Well, Dan, we appreciate it. We knocked out an hour show, just the two of us. So great stuff. We've got to cover a lot of different topics, so it's good to see. Well, the week off for spring break. We don't take the week off. USCfootball.com will still have a bunch of content up there, but they'll be back again next week and stuff like that. So thanks again. Make sure you send in your questions, any kind of spring break questions you have. You can send them to USCfootball.com, podcast@USCfootball.com. And thanks again, Dan, for coming on the show.
Hey, and if you are looking for something this spring, go check out the USC baseball team. Definitely worth worth a look. They do it the right way. They've done a great job of building the program. Coach Hobbs in the third year, and they're fun to watch. And college baseball is a great sport. And now that the Trojans look like they're back in business, get out there and see some games, and I think you'll really enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Dan. Thanks again. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Peristyle Podcast. We will talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.